Hello, I'm Dominic King. This time on Talking. Television presenter and singer Cheryl Baker, a member of the 1981 Eurovision-winning Bucks Fizz. Born in the heart of the East End, now living in a Kent village of just 350, and that's where we met, at her family home.
You're going to hear my dog panting in the background.
Cupid is a massive dog, Cheryl.
He's beautiful, isn't he? He's a long-haired German Shepherd. He breathes very heavy. So if anyone listening to this hears heavy breathing, it's not me, it's my dog.
I've known you on the air as Cheryl Baker.
Yes.
But actually, I also know that that is not your actual name.
No. Well, that's because in 1975, I joined my first band. And these are the exact words. I saw an advert in the Melody Maker for a girl singer required for a harmony band. And this is not Bucks Fizz. This was 6 years before Bucks Fizz. And I rang the number and I spoke to a manager. His name was Slim Miller.
What a great name.
Yeah. He was a comedian. And then he turned, changed his career and made himself an agent. He used to look after the New Seekers, actually. And the band that I was hoping to have a job with, which were called Mother's Pride at the time. And so I rang and he said, Slim Miller. And I said, oh, I'm ringing about the advert in the Melody Maker. And he said, what's your name? And I said, Rita Crudgington. And he said, well, that'll have to go.
So Rita
Crudgington.
Rita Crudgington.
Yes.
Cheryl Baker.
Yes.
Welcome to Talking.
Thank you very much. I auditioned for the band. I got the job. And they said, you have to change your name. So I did. I changed it to Bonnie Silver. And I was Bonnie Silver for 2 weeks. And then they said, actually, we don't like that. That's, where Rita Crudgington wasn't stagey enough. They thought Bonnie Silver was too stagey. So we came up with Cheryl Baker. And Dom, I tell you this without a word of a lie, I don't even remember who came up with the names. It might have been me, it might not have been. The band were in summer season in Blackpool. And so I had to go up to Blackpool and learn all the songs. I was replacing one of the girls who was leaving and stayed in a house. They had a house share. And so of an evening they were working and during the day they were rehearsing with me. And I remember all of us sitting round in the lounge of this house in Blackpool coming up with ideas for names. And I think I might have chosen Baker because it's, when you have to spell Crudgington to people.
How much do you use that? Obviously not now and because of being married, but... And, well, there was another thing as well. So with Steve, what's Steve's?
Stroud. So I am now Rita Stroud.
Right.
But I didn't get married until I was just before my 38th birthday. So so I stayed Crudgington until I was almost 38. But Baker, we changed it to Baker. I don't think it was me that chose Cheryl, but I don't really remember. And I said to my mum, I rang my mum and I went, Mum, change my name again. And she went, oh, Rita, what am I going to call you? And I went, Mum, I'm still Rita. And my friends from school, who I still see to this day, they went, oh, that's going to be really weird calling you by something else. And I went, you don't have to call me something else. It's still me, I'm still me. Cheryl Baker goes on stage. And that's how I've kept it, Dom, all those years. And it's going to be, next year, it's going to be 50 years that I've been in this industry. 50 years of being Cheryl Baker. But in my heart and in my head, I'm still Rita Crudgington from Bethnal Green.
You have a very grounded start because you're a very sort of tight-knit community.
Yes.
Was that very much part of your family life growing up?
Absolutely. I knew nothing. The first time I went abroad, I was 19, and I went with my Aunt Ive and Uncle Bert and my cousin Lorraine. I'd never been on a plane before. I've still got the photos of me going on the plane, wow. My life was very much surrounding Bethnal Green and just beyond. So when I left school, I got a job as a secretary in the city so I could get the number 8 bus to Shoreditch or I could jump on the train to Liverpool Street and And, you know, there were jobs, ten a penny in those days for shorthand typists, which is what I was. Pittman's, by the way. I can still do it.
Hello.
I don't know when you're going to need a proper job.
At any stage, it could happen, couldn't it? But that, I mean, that in itself is like, that's amazing. It's like a blast from the past for so many people, because they'll say, oh, the Pittman's typing test, amazing.
Well, when I do my shows on the ships, I do a story called My Life, Cheryl Baker, My Life. And I talk about, you know, the early days. And I say that I used to be a shorthand typist. And I say, Pittman's, anyone do Pittman's? And so many of the women say, yeah, well, I do Pittman's. But anyway, so that was it. I used to get the bus or the train to Liverpool Street to go to work, which really, you know, it's probably a 45-minute walk I could have done it in. And holidays, we only ever went to Laysdown-on-Sea on the Isle of Sheppey. And so that was it for me. Laysdown in the summer with my family, living and working and school in sort of East London and EC1 area or EC2. And that was it. I did nothing. And that was my life. My life was in a tiny little area. And then when I auditioned for this band in 1975, I had to get the bus from Victoria to Blackpool. And my sister came to see me off. I was 21. And she was crying because I'd never been anywhere. I'd never done anything. And it was a massive step for me to do it. It was a massive risk. I'm doing something on my own. I'd never been away, never left home. I didn't leave home when I was in Bucks Fizz, you know.
It was frightening, I guess.
Yeah, but also I liked being at home. You know, I had a fantastic family life. My mum and dad, especially my mum, was just glorious. Sang from, you know, the time she woke up to the time she went to bed. Was very untidy, a bit like me, but always busy, always making food. I love cooking. I get that from my mum, and I get a lot from my mum, actually. Her cooking and her music, definitely. But and her untidiness, I'm afraid. She's not that she was lazy, and not that I'm lazy, but if she peeled potatoes, she would leave the peeling and go on to do something else. And so the peeling was left there. And then she'd do something else. She'd do the Brussels sprouts, and she'd leave the trimmings of the Brussels sprouts. And so she used to leave this debris behind her wherever she went.
What's your mum's name?
Well, her name was Florence, but everyone called her Dolly. And my dad was Edward, and everyone called him Ted. So my mum and dad were called Dolly and Teddy.
That's genius, isn't it? Oh, but they were lovely.
Yeah, they were. My dad was a shoemaker. I tell you what. My dad worked. I bought them a house in the end, and that was when he stopped working. And then I had to buy my own shoes. I remember going into wherever it was, going, how much? Because he used to make them for me. He worked in a factory. He wasn't a cobbler as such. But he was also, you know, he was born in 1915, so he was 23 when he went into the army, and in the Second World War. And he was a sergeant major in the Second World War, and when he came back, he still was, you know, he used to march like a sergeant major, and he was very regimented and everything, times, and, you know, just like people in the army are.
Yeah.
You know, so we're completely different from my mum.
You know, you said about buying a house, was that through Bucks Fizz and the success that you had?
That was my primary thing that I wanted to do. We lived in a council flat in Bethnal Green. And I must say, I loved it. I really loved it. And I was born there. I was born in the front room of that council flat. It's only all I'd ever known. And when I won the Eurovision, I was 27. So all the neighbours I knew, you know, people didn't move in and out. You know, if you were born there, you stayed there, sort of thing. And that's how things were in Bethnal Green then. And so all of the neighbours, all the people in the blocks of flats either side, I knew everybody. I didn't want to move out at all. And then we won the Eurovision, and suddenly I had some money coming in. My dad at that time, he was past retirement. He was about 66, 67. And I thought, he's going to be kicked out. They're going to say, Ted, you're too old. And what's he going to do then? Living in a block of flats. He loved gardening. He used to grow tomatoes in the just in the windowsills and things. And I thought, what is my dad? My mum will cope wherever she is, but my dad won't. And so I thought, I've got to buy him a house. And I was very fortunate that I could afford to. So it was great. It was fantastic. I went and found the house. It was in Basildon. And the reason I chose Basildon was because it's an overspill of East London.
Right.
Okay. I didn't want them to feel like out of their depth.
So again, it's that kind of like metropolitan Kent. It's just near Essex. It's that kind of almost crossover point.
Yeah. So I came in. I remember coming into them and saying, "Mum and Dad, I bought you a house. Do you want to see it?" And it was a semi-detached little house, small garden, but round the corner there was some shops and there was a little club where my dad could go. And that's where they finished their days, in that house. So it was great.
At the time we're talking, you just mentioned about Eurovision. I was thinking about, you know, it's the 50th anniversary of ABBA winning at Brighton. Those years and the year that you won with Buck's Fizz, they're kind of this golden age of music almost, in the sense of, certainly for Eurovision, I think.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like being in the Olympics, isn't it? In the sense of, once you've won one, or once you've won an Oscar, a BAFTA, you always have won an Oscar, a BAFTA.
Yeah.
You guys will always have won Eurovision. For you, is that kind of a kind of mixed blessing about Eurovision, or are you proud of it?
I'm incredibly proud of it. I mean, it was something that a childhood dream. When I saw Sandy Shaw in 1967, and I thought, that funny you should mention the Olympics, because I wanted to be an Olympic runner. I loved running. I loved sport. I still love sport. And I thought I was going to join a Victoria Park Harriers, which was the local sports club, but I couldn't afford to. Yeah, I wanted to be an Olympic runner. And then I saw Sandy Shaw win the Eurovision, and I thought, actually, that's what I want to do. That's like winning the Olympics, but in music. So that became... I still want to win an Olympic gold, obviously.
Okay, yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, there's still time. But do you think you win because you've got a song that just can talk to everyone?
Yeah, I do. I think that's what happened with Making Your Mind Up. And I say, it's not my cup of tea, Making Your Mind Up. Never has been. You know, I like James Taylor and Joni Mitchell. Can you imagine James Taylor singing Making Your Mind Up?
He'd do it well,
would be amazing, yeah. Lyrically, not so much, but yeah.
But you don't like that song?
No. But how can I knock it? It changed my life.
Right.
I met Sandy Shaw for the very first time last year up in Liverpool. And I said to her, "You don't know how much you mean to me. You changed my life. You gave me the incentive not just to be a singer, but to do the Eurovision Song Contest." Mm. And she was very nonchalant about it. And almost sort of brushed it off. But I thought, you just don't know. You just don't realise what a difference you made to my life. And it's funny because I know that that's happened with us. I know, for instance, this is going off piste here, but what's her name? Rekai?
Bianca.
Bianca.
Yes, the character Bianca.
Yes, her real name is Julie. And I knew her as a little girl because her mum and dad ran a pub. And my boyfriend at the time, we used to pop into this pub.
Patsy Palmer,
but her real name's Julie. But there was a Julie Palmer, I think, already. So we used to go into the pub because it was en route to his house. And she was so excited because I was in Buck's Fizz, you know. And she had this beautiful red hair, as she has. Anyway, she wanted to come. She was a big fan and she wanted to come and see us. And I don't know where we did it, Hammersmith at Apollo or Dominion or wherever. And she was in the front row and I got her up. And she's met the guys either before the show or after. I don't remember it. Don't remember doing it. And then I bumped into her at an event after she'd become a big star in EastEnders. And she said, "You don't remember meeting me, do you?" And I went, "No." And she said, "My mum and dad used to run." I went, "Oh, they run that pub, that's right." And she went, "But do you remember inviting us to a gig?" And she said, "You'll never know how much that meant to me." She said, "I cried. I cried because I was overwhelmed with emotion." And I thought, blimey, you know, you don't imagine that you could mean that much to somebody. And yet you do.
What was it like to be surrounded by musicians from all over Europe, all doing a similar thing? What was that feeling like? Do you remember that period, especially with that song?
Well, I did Eurovision twice. I did it in 1978 as well. In Paris with the band that originally were called Mother's Pride, that eventually became Coco, same band, slight different lineup. It's a bit strange, to be perfectly honest, when you're surrounded with people that are talking different languages. And I went up to Liverpool. I was very much involved in Liverpool last year when it was in the UK. And then again, you know, you've got all the different countries, all their own, they've got all their own different areas. and they keep to them.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's not like a big party where everyone mixes.
Because that's what it feels like when you're watching it on the telly.
Yeah.
So it's not?
No, they do kind of keep to their own tribe, if you know what I mean. It is very tribal, Eurovision. But, I mean, some of them, I mean, we got on, when we did Eurovision in Dublin as Bucks Fizz, we were very, very friendly with the Irish contingent. They were great, the Irish band. They were absolutely lovely. But not really anybody else. And in Paris, I don't remember being sort of having a conversation with anyone other than our own party. So, it's a bit weird, really.
Ollie Alexander is our entry for this time round. What do you think about that, almost having people who are known for their own pop career and getting them to, or a YouTube star like Sam, you know, getting them to be the voice of Eurovision now, rather than it potentially being people who are unknown in the past, maybe, that then become really big?
Or known. I think it's fine. I think it's the way things have moved. You know, Eurovision has moved on dramatically, massively, compared to how it was when we did it, and certainly compared to how it was when ABBA did it. And in fact, I spoke to a Bucks Fizz fan. We did a little gig a couple of weeks ago in Tunbridge, funny enough, in the old fire station. It's tiny, and it only takes about 80 to 100, but it's the real ardent fans, the fans that want to know every detail of everything. They don't want to hear Making Your Mind Up and Land of Make-Believe. They want to hear the obscure album tracks and stuff like that. So anyway, I remember talking to someone there who said that it's been suggested that for Eurovision events now, they should only go back to the year 2000. So because, and if you think about it, I mean, that's 24 years.
Yeah, but when you said that, my brain was like, well, that sounds a bit, that 20 years odd, I mean, 24 years.
But it eliminates every single British entry that's won, single one. And it eliminates the likes of Waterloo and so many other great songs. But I do kind of get it because, as I say, it has moved on so much and the songs are so dramatic now and the production and everything. I mean, Making Your Mind Up, if you put Making Your Mind Up in the Eurovision now, we'd get nil point. You know, it's moved on.
When that comes up as a track list on a song for you at an event that you do, when you know it's coming and you don't really like the song, is that tough to do?
No, I mean, I don't like the song because it's not my kind of song, but I love performing it. I love it. And I'm the one who introduces it. And I always say, oh, well, I suppose we better do that silly song, haven't we? And I don't even have to introduce it. They all go, yes! And the scream goes up and they all come out with their phones ready to get the moment when the skirts come off. And yes, we still pull the skirts off.
I think I've said to you over the years about the Velcro, you know, because I think in those early days, getting that right was quite a thing, wasn't it?
What we did with the skirts when we did the competition, to make sure that the boys didn't miss, we put a brooch so that they could grab the brooch. And if you got the brooch, then the skirt's going to come off. And it worked perfect.
It was a treat, wasn't it? It was really, really good. The music industry itself, my dad would always say, you know, got the T-shirt. I mean, you would say got the duvet as well, which I don't know what that was all about. But, you know, this has been a really interesting part of your life. You know, as I look around this room, you know, there are guitars up everywhere. I know you're a music family as well. That's really, there's always struck me. I know your two daughters who have loved music over the years. Was it ever a question for you to say to them about the music industry and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing to be involved with? Did you ever have that conversation?
Yeah, we did. In Steve's words, he said to the girls, I want you to either be a vet or a knee surgeon. and I said, just...
Good jobs though, aren't they?
Yes, they are. I said to them, just to have something else that you can fall back on, like I did. You know, I studied, I wanted to be a singer, but I thought it might not happen. And so study as a secretary, you know, and so you've always got a job. But they both ignored me completely and they just went down the music route.
Which is what kids do.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't. The reason I didn't was because I didn't think that I would be successful. You know, Rita Crudgington from Bethnal Green, who would want to work with her?
But Natalie and Kyla both had a great rapport with each other musically, which I've seen, obviously, and Kyla in her own solo world as well, yeah, doing great things, again, under a different name.
Lakey, because there is a... She was going to go out as just Kyla, but there's... I think she's Thai, a girl called Kyla, and quite successful. And so Kyla had to change her name. So she chose Lakey, and I thought, oh, I'm not sure about that, but... I don't know, it seems to have worked.
It really has worked, and to a modern age group, I guess, you know, we're not the right age for it. But the modern age group, I love the music, and I like the way, when I work with them both, you know, in a studio, they just know their stuff, and they're very talented, and you must be so proud of what they've achieved, because that's been their ability to kind of probably soak up a little bit of you guys.
Do you know about Public the Musical? Kyla wrote... In lockdown, Kyla started writing music. She decided that she was fed up a bit with trying to make hit records and things. She loves musicals, both the kids. I've raised them, you know, much to Steve's dismay.
It's all right, he's in the other room, he can't hear.
My rock star bass playing husband. Yeah, I've raised them to love musicals. And so she... Kyla decided that she wanted to write a musical. Kyla is gay, for a start. She's all about equality and, you know, and diversity and everything. So she wrote this, all of these fabulous songs, and then she wrote the storybook with Natalie, and Natalie helped her with the lyrics. And it's about four completely diverse people. One is an activist, another is... a gay man who suffers from anxiety. Another one is non-binary. And the other is a very macho, you know, man's man. And they get locked in a gender-neutral toilet. They did Fringe in 2023 and took it by storm.
Amazing.
It was the hot ticket. And can I tell you how I know it was? Not only did they sell out, from day one they sold out every single show. I walked into the venue... And I saw Gail Porter. And I know that Gail has got a son or a daughter, roughly Kyla and Natalie's age, because we used to do little events for the children and we'd both be there. And she went, oh, Cheryl, we had a hug. And what are you doing here? How are your girls? And I went, well, funny enough, they've written this musical. She went, what's it called? And I said, it's called Public the Musical. And she went, oh, hang on a minute, Public. And she called over a friend. Happy birthday, happy birthday.
Da, 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 da.
Who happened to be Claire Grogan from Altered Images. And she went, Claire, what was that show you told me I've got to see? And Claire said, oh, she said, it's the hot ticket, but you can't get one. They're all sold out. It was Public the Musical. And I went, oh, my daughter's wrote it. So, honestly, Dom, it's going to be... I've just been talking to the girls today about it, and it's going to be touring, we think... in spring of 25.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
But what did you say to them about whether they should or shouldn't go into the music industry?
I said, I didn't say don't. I mean, you can't... The thing is, you're born with this. This is not a proper job. You know, this is not work. This is play. We love it. We love what we do. If you're born with music in your soul, there's nothing you can do about it. It's there. It's part of you. And so I couldn't take that away from them. But all I said to them was... just be sensible and have something else up your sleeve that you can do. And I suppose Natalie has, because Natalie trained as a dancer, and she teaches, she choreographs, she teaches dance, she directs. She's actually, if you look on YouTube at some of the videos that the Fizz have done, like TOTP, you can see Natalie in TOTP, and also Winning Ways. There's quite a few, actually. She choreographed them. She's fantastic. She's so great at what she does. So they're both in the industry, and this is their life now. That's what they're going to do for the rest of their lives.
Over the years, you've done such a variety of things in the entertainment industry. The day job, if you like, has been that music side of your life. But you've also been on our TV screens as a presenter, and we've seen you on different things. I want to take you back to the days of that show Record Breakers, with Roy Castle, you, and Norris Maguerta with the records from the Guinness World Records book, yeah. which still unbelievably comes out every year and still being bought by millions of people. Millions, yeah. Amazing. But that show, what was that period of your life like? Having that kind of, you did the music, but you also were, you know, on the front line of our entertainment industry. You were there. You were one of those faces.
Yeah. I started with Record Breakers in 1987, I think it was. And so I was still in Bucks Fizz. I was still gigging with Bucks Fizz, but we'd had the hits. The hits had dried up. The last hit, the last top 10 hit we had was in 86. And so I was still with them and we were still working, but our work was getting less, you know, and less exciting sort of thing. And the television for me was taking over. And when I was doing Record Breakers, shortly after that, I did a series called Eggs and Baker, and my television career was taking off. So by the time I left Bucks Fizz, which was December 93, literally I regarded myself as a television presenter. I didn't regard myself as a singer anymore. But my Record Breakers days were glorious, especially working with Roy Castle. And I feel sorry that, you know, there are people like my children, they don't know who Roy Castle is. The last time I saw Roy was after I'd given birth to my girls, and Natalie was very poorly. She was in intensive care. And he came to see her. And that was the last time I saw him before he died of cancer. But it was the most fantastic series to work on, because you're working with extreme people. You're working with people that want to be the best at what they can do. And some of the records were silly, but some of them were extraordinary.
Yeah.
And life-threatening, you know. They would risk their lives so that they could be the best at what they were doing.
It was like watching a show at the same time as Blue Peter, these kind of shows that were really at their heyday, that you felt like you were watching adventure live. You know, yeah. This was in your face. There was a jeopardy about it. Mm-hmm. There was a sense of, I think, with the Norris Maguerta character obviously coming in as the expert. And, I mean, yeah. I have to say, he felt quite school head teachery to me,
yes.
And you guys were the, you know, that you were me. You were both the school kids playing in the room almost, you know, that and there was a great chemistry between you and Roy, and that sense also of from my own memory of there was a lot of laughter on that show.
I tell you what, Roy had the most fantastic sense of humour, and quite a wicked sense of humour as well. He was very naughty. We'd stand at the back of the studio while they were trying to break a record in front of us, and he was going, "Go on, you can do it." And he would whisper to me, "They're never going to do this," you know. And it really used to make me laugh. He was lovely. He was glorious to work with.
Did you? Because you even said there at the beginning about when we were talking about it, I almost could hear the music playing in the background. The voice of Roy as well. It was a really great voice, wasn't it?
He was an all-rounder. He was the archetypal all-rounder. He could sing, he could dance. I've always thought that he should have been Bert in Mary Poppins.
Oh, yeah.
He would have been perfect. Yeah. But, you know, they wanted an American to appeal.
But he would
have, yeah, of course. He would have had the right accent and everything rather than...
Hello, Mary Poppins.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you're like from Bethel Green, go, what the hell? But those kind of shows, they're hard work too, aren't they?
We did have, in the studio, we did have auto cue for that. But when I started presenting television, there was no auto cue. And in those days, they used to, you know, now you see them with their script in their hand and they'll refer to their script. Well, in those days, when I started, my first television presenting was in 1984 with a show called How Dare You. And it was taboo to have your script in your hand. So sometimes I'd write notes on the palm of my hand, you know. But you had to do your homework. And so the night before recording, or night before, if it was a live show, you'd spend hours before going to bed just going over your script and going over, reading up on people and learning about them, because you're going to interview them. And it was a hard job. But I did enjoy it. But I know you said about music industry, like my music career being my day job. I didn't class that as my day job. My day job was the TV presenting, because that was like going to work, getting it done and coming home. Whereas the music, to this day, I just love. I love going on stage and performing. That's not work for me.
Whether it's in front of a TV camera for a presentation job, or whether it's performing on a stage as The Fizz and having that connection with an audience, Is it something you're always nervous about before you go onto the stage? Is it a giddiness? Is it an overexcitement? What is the feeling?
Right, depends. If I'm going on stage with Fizz, like for instance, this weekend we're doing an 80s weekender at Bognor, Butlins. I don't get nervous at those. I don't get nervous because they are chomping at the bit for you to come on stage.
They love you being there.
They do. They really do. And we go on stage and inevitably there'll be four people. There might be several four peoples, if you know what I mean. Four groups of four dressed as Bucks Fizz. They've gone to Smithies or whatever it is, and they've hired a Bucks Fizz outfit. Yeah, they ripped the skirt off at the right time and everything. It's hilarious, honestly. But and so I love those gigs, and I don't get nervous. I revel in them. I run on stage, and the cheer goes up, and I can't wait to perform, and get them going and everything. Then there's other things. There's musicals. I've done lots of musicals. I pace up and down in the wings, going over my lines and hating myself for being so nervous. Now, unfortunately, with television and when you've got auto cue, my eyesight has failed now. My distance eyesight has failed. And so I really have to, I find myself squinting, which you don't want to squint on telly, you know. So it's that television. I did used to get nervous. I don't do so much of it now. I'm more of a guest now.
You do panel shows and stuff.
Yeah, I just did one a few days ago. I did House of Games. And before that, I was in Dictionary Corner on Countdown. This is in the last couple of weeks. So I get invited to do those kind of shows now. But that I'm not at all nervous about those. Although quiz shows are a bit nerve-wracking, The Chase especially.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah. I was really nervous about The Chase, but I did get 8 in my cash builder, so I was very pleased. But yeah, musicals. I've said to my agent, I can't do musicals anymore because my nerves can't take it. I did Footloose the musical for a year, and even up to the last day of that year, I was still, before going on stage, pacing up and down, going, "Oh, don't forget your lines, Rita. Don't forget your lines." See, I still call myself Rita. I did do another one after that, actually. I did Happy Days, the musical. I might have done a few after that.
Did you find it easy to learn the lines?
No.
So that terrifies me, that idea of that. I loved doing plays at school. That's always been a thing when I've talked to actor friends about, how on earth do you just keep that in your head all the time?
Yeah.
But isn't that the same as you knowing how a song sounds?
I don't know. Songs, you can... I don't know, you can fit the words in and just kind of... I remember songs quite easily. But we watch a lot of dramas, me and Steve, on telly. And I just think to myself, how do they know their lines? How do they remember them? And with musicals, I have done plays as well. Some of them even serious plays, like Dial M for Murder I did once. And I dried on stage. I was sitting on a sofa and I had to be terribly, terribly posh. I had a terribly posh accent. And I was sitting with my co-actor and I looked at him and he knew that I was blank. I didn't... And he said my line for me. And it frightened the living daylights out of me, Dom. And I've done it a few times, actually, in different musicals. I did it once in the West End when I was on Footloose. I did it in the middle of a song. I completely forgot it.
What do you do?
I stopped. And the pianist went, dung, 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 dung. I went, can you find it in your heart to forgive her? And then nothing. Didn't know what the next line was. And the pianist looked at me and he went, bung, bing, bung, bing. And I went, bung, bing, bung, bing. And honestly, it was awful. And Steve McGann, who's the doctor in... called The Midwife. He was playing opposite me. He was my husband in the show. And he went, oh, and he stood up and he came and hugged me. And I went, and I started crying. But it was just nerves. I just couldn't remember it. It was awful. So I can't bear those times. And so no. I said to my agent, I don't want to ever do it again.
So you won't do it?
It depends. Okay. It will be either because it's a show that I really, really want to do, although I can't think of one off the top of my head. Or because I'm really poor.
Finally, you know, you've been part of this soundtrack to our lives too. You mentioned earlier about, you know, loving James Taylor and Joni Mitchell. and all the influences that we've had, you know, me on being on the radio and playing all the music that I've played over the years as well. What is it about us as human beings, do you think, that we just really... Music is not just an accompaniment to our life. No. I don't think it is. That's not just for people who are really enthusiastic about music. I think for everyone on the planet, music is it, isn't it?
It takes you to a place and time in your life. When we do these 80s weekends of festivals throughout the summer, you know that you're taking that audience back to a time when they might have been, you know, teenagers or even younger. And for that moment while you're on stage, they're not thinking about woes, they're not thinking about troubles, they're not thinking about work, they're just in the moment and having a great time. And I think for me, music takes me not just to another place and time, but also it makes me happy, it makes me sad, it makes me think, you know, I hear a song, my mum used to like that, makes me think of my mum. It's so important to me in my life, and I think to most people. And I can't imagine what it would be like to not have music in your life. I cannot comprehend a life without music.
Cheryl Baker, Rita, thanks for being with me on Talking.
It's a great pleasure. Always, Dom. Always to see you.
And how good was Cuba?
I know. He starts off a bit, you know, hang on a minute. Let's get to know this bloke. I'll give him my ball, see if he wants to play with me. He always does that. A new person comes in, they get the ball treatment.
I love it.
Thanks for listening. The music to Talking is composed by Johnny Easton. Talking is a Laughing Frog production.